obviously there's a congeniality. My recollections of Jung taking us out to dinner, organizing the whole group to bring our own bottles and drive down to Smyrna.
So we had Omni Hut, right.
Yeah, and we would have parties there. That was part of the whole atmosphere. And it was a key role, I think, in the morale of the department.
The department partied together, socialized together. We were all one big group, one big family.
It wasn't just, in those days, the divisions, people fighting each other. Somehow or other, we came to much more pleasant conclusions than it turned into, and money became more scarce, and the department grew bigger, and there was competition for resources. Mm-hmm. I remember Bruce Masterton wanting a few extra $100 and not being able to get it when Thistlethwaite was chairman, and calling up his friends and saying, I want out of here. I remember that clearly. Yeah. Hated to see that.
Big loss.
He was, he like Bob Fox, you know, talk about almost anything. Mm-hmm. I can remember problems in the department. I remember having conversations with Dick Blant. And of course, there's this wonderful time at the 18-wheeler drove up after we went to the Army surplus and loaded the department up with everything.
Pat Blanton still reminds me, I mean, Pat Byrne still tells me about that, about how Dorothy got upset when that 18-wheeler showed up.
Yeah, of course. But it was all over the place, every room, every hallway, there. And we didn't realize that that's what was going to happen when the guy said, you know, why don't you take all this money? It was some ridiculous sum of money.
$25.
Yeah, it was really crazy. Because what Dick was looking for, oscilloscopes, things that he could use in his hearing research, you know. And suddenly the guy made this motion, and Dick just said five. It floored me.
Were you chair then?
I don't remember what I was chair about at that point. But that's one thing,
great story,
that really sticks out very much. And there was the Masterton episode. There were some other ones too. I enjoyed very much that the department accepted my role in music. That was, there were two things that occurred. One was when I got the call to go down and play with Brenda Lee or the Chuba Montenegro for the first time, because I hadn't touched the violin in a long time. And I still had one, but it had been a long time since I had played any serious music. I continued. I actually had a little chamber group at Syracuse when I was there. The chemistry professor was a violist, and his wife was a cellist. And they heard I was a violinist, so they got a hold of me, and we started doing things together. And so I played chamber music with them. And then I organized a little string group, and we do things like a Bach Brandenburg, and he would play, you know, the harpsichord and the piano, and I conducted and played the fiddle. So I did keep up in that way. But then I got here, and I got this call. They heard I was a violinist, and they needed 18 violins, and I didn't know where they were going to get 18 violins. And I didn't even have strings on the instrument there. I'd go and get strings, get the thing tuned up, and I was worried, you know, I had practiced. And I walked into the studio down at Quonset Hut, that used to be Columbia, and Harold Bradley, the well-known Harold, and his brother, actually. What was the brother's name? Harold was the one who became, he was a guitar player, and he's still, I think, the president of the union here. But I walked into that place, and it was just an old Quonset hut with partitions set up. And they bring out this music, and it's all what we call footballs. That is nothing to play, really. Just, you know, you play the nice sound, and that's it. And this hand comes around with the ball. It goes, one, two, three, four, and we're off. And that's the end of it. We're sitting there, and we're playing footballs. And that, I'm getting what? At that time it was like $65 or $68 for sitting there doing that, you know? I said, wow. And then Brenda Lee was the next one that called me. And then they discovered that I was the best violinist in town. And that's when I was picked up to do the solos, and that's why everybody wanted me to come.
Weren't you a concert master or assistant concert master?
I had been, yeah. I was a concert master of the Hartford Chamber Orchestra, assistant concert master in the regular orchestra. But that's awful work. You don't like to do that stuff. I don't like orchestral playing. I did play in the orchestra here for one season. I was lucky to have a good conductor came in there. It was good to work with a good conductor. So that was really neat, and everybody seemed to enjoy it when they came to sessions, and it didn't interfere with my work, so it was fun. But I must admit that it was very well paid. I earned more 7 years in background music than I did as a college professor. And for years I still get royalties.
Do you?
I haven't played a record session since Robert Mandrell in November of 1981. If you go on the internet and put in Martin Catan, you'll still see records with my name on it.
Wow.
At Amazon.com. I'm still getting royalties. The biggest royalty coup, the biggest coup there was Miller High Life did their advertising. Remember the Miller High Life ads from the 1970s? And I couldn't do both sessions. I only could do one session there. And the royalties from that over just in a 2-year period paid $2,000. And I still, I bought movie tracks, but I still get royalties from those movie tracks. I guess, what is it, Somebody and the Bandit? What was it, one of those? Smokey and the Bandit?
Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah, I like that track. So I get royalties. So I haven't played that. And then I got to know Johnny Cash, and I did all of his record sessions. And when he was doing the TV show, he asked me to be his concert master when the live TV show came. At that time, I was department chairman, and I told him I could not make rehearsals because faculty meetings were at 4 o'clock. And he said, I don't care. You sent the substitute for the faculty meeting. I want you at the performance at night. So I hired a girl to go in and sit in for me at the rehearsals, and then I would show up at night, tuxedo at night, and play the concert at the Grand Ole Opry downtown. Yeah, it was great. I had a great time doing that. So I do have good memories of that, great memories of the department. I would never have been successful with my guidebooks if I hadn't been a faculty member of that. There would have been no entree into the field. And that is a good story, too, by the way, because the two women who encouraged me to write what I was doing in the weight management program, one was copy editor for Eric Erickson, and the other was an editor at Thomas Nelson. The religious book. And the editor at Thomas Nelson made contact with 6 publishers for me, and they all turned it down. One of them, who was the editor of the Beverly Hills Diet, said, the American public is much too dumb to understand what you're trying to say in this book. But I picked up a Writer's Digest, and I looked up agents. And one was publishing Billie Jean King, and also doing the pop psychologist. See his picture clearly as they looking back here. I said, he's got a psychologist on the roster, he's got Billie Jean King on the roster, I'll send him my stuff. And I sent him the first chapter, which the copy editor had helped me write, so that I would write good advertising copy, you know.
Uh-huh.
So she helped me write that. I met with her at the IHOP, and she would review what I had written for my proposals and the chapters that I sent off. And Arthur Pine took it on, and within 2 weeks he had publishers competing for it. And when I went to, this was very good, because I went to New York, Star Lawrence had already published a book by a couple at University of Pennsylvania on weight management. That's another name I'll remember soon. And he knew what he was talking about when I started talking about what I wanted to do and what he wanted to do, and he never asked the question, what's the hook? That's what they, all the publishers want to know, what's the hook? How are you going to, he wanted to know what it was going to be about, whether it had any status, whether there was anything behind what I was saying. And that was the 200 calorie solution. Where I was simply telling people there's a 200 calorie difference between your 50 pounds overweight. Now you lose it. You better exercise 200 calories more, cut back 200 calories more. And that's pretty much what the fat cells would need to stay alive. You can either burn it with 50 pounds of fat on your body or by doing a couple of miles of walking. That was the basic theory of that book. So they took it out. And I've been with Martin ever since. And altogether, I think I've sold, God knows, 10, 12 million books altogether. Yeah. Mostly the little fat companies, but they're still out there selling. So. Nick Hobbs said to me, once you do that, you're going to have a lot of problems in the department. There's going to be a lot of people. He took me aside, and he said, Dick, you need to be very sensitive to the fact that you're going to have colleagues who don't like what you're doing. And, in some minimal way that did occur on one or two occasions, but it was very minimal.
What kind of thing?
Well, see, one of the things that happened was that I was on a book tour when an honors student was coming up for his examination. And the committee did not take kindly to the fact that I was on a book tour with my student.
That was your student?
Yeah, it was my student. In fact, it was the student who had done the research on the rotation diet.
Uh-huh.
And this was where we had examined metabolic rates of the people who were in the program to see whether there had been any metabolic changes in the rate of respiration, calorie burning, during the period of time while they were on this rotation diet. And it was his research that we quoted on this. But evidently I was not there, and there were defects in research of this kind. I mean, people had legitimate claims to make, I guess. They made it tougher on the student than needed to be. The examination had to be rescheduled after they made their objections.
Oh, like so they had to have another examination, which was very unusual.
That's right, in programs, yeah. But everything did work out okay, and Randy Newman gave me a great tennis shirt. I used to play tennis with him. He was my honors student. Did you ever meet Randy Newman?
I don't remember.
Okay, well, Randy Newman was a very bright, good student, excellent tennis player, varsity tennis player in high school, and would have played on the varsity here, but he did not want to spend the time on it. But we used to go out and play tennis together. He also was something of a bodybuilder, and I never beat him a set of tennis until one day. It was 95 degrees. He was in a tank top on the Vanderbilt court showing off his muscles. He was walking around with no hat either. And I had learned this technique from the Australians that, you know, you put ice around, you put ice on your head, you put caps on every time you change the thing. Well, by the end of the first of the set, he could not even hardly move anymore. And I won my only set against Randy Newman that day.
The Australian trick.
Yeah, they used to freeze cabbages, put it on their head, put a hat with cabbage, and keep themselves cool, keep the blood cool. I used that when I used to run with some of my friends who were doing marathon training. I never did a marathon, but they were going down to do the peach tree. And we went out in the heat in the Percy Warner. And I wrapped ice in towels and put it on my head under the cap. And they were too good for that, you know. I was the only one to last 2 miles even that day. It was so
Okay. Listen, I'm very appreciative of your time and willingness to
it's fun to
help us
like
with this.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that the recorder will last longer than the two of us.